Good afternoon and welcome to Ask the Mayor on WBAA. I'm Stan Jastrzebski. In studio with me this week for our inaugural venture into the unknown is West Lafayette Mayor John Dennis. Thanks for being here.
How you doing, Stan?
Pretty good. If you've got a question for Mayor Dennis during our next half hour, please do call us at 496-1999, 496-1999. You can also send an email to ask@wbaa.org, or you can tweet your question to @WBAAnews on Twitter, and I'll be able to see that right here and ask it of the mayor almost instantaneously. Well, let me start with there was talk this in the last week or so that a private venture firm out of Chicago has become the leading bidder to take over Amtrak service in or around October. And you have been on the record as being somewhat critical of Amtrak as having service that's slow or unreliable. I was curious what your reaction was to the idea of having that private operator take over the line between Indianapolis and Chicago, which of course runs through Lafayette, West Lafayette.
Well, I think actually, you know, we need to go back and do a little bit of history here. The fact that Amtrak has been providing substandard service isn't really a secret to our community. And in Purdue and West Lafayette, we're probably the biggest users. I mean, we have a lot of international students that use the Amtrak line to Chicago sort of as a lifeline to get home. And the unfortunate reality is that they're dependent upon a timely service, which would empower them to be able to get to their flights with enough time to be suitable to get on the service. We have realized that the service itself is pretty lacking in efficiency. We've actually done some test rides. We've checked the route ourselves physically, and we've come to the realization that not only is the service somewhat slow, but the cars are fairly substandard as well. But speaking historically, that line is actually what they call a hospital line. Years ago, that was basically put in place to bring cars to a shipyard to where the cars could be maintenanced. So it really wasn't originally designed for passenger rail. But since that time, it's obviously evolved to where it's become something that we're somewhat dependable upon. Well, with all that understanding, we decided that there is a need for us to try and see what we can do. Those of us in local government felt that it was important that we get involved and we check with our citizens to see if they were supportive of that. And they, specifically in this area, were overwhelmingly so. So we thought that it would be, first off, important to check with Amtrak and say, hey, guys, you know, your service is a little lousy, and is there something that you can do to help improve it? And so they went ahead and went through some checklists to see if they could, and they're in the process of trying to improving that. But also the state got involved. And at that point, the state felt that it might not be the best investment when it comes to looking at transportation options for the citizens of the state of Indiana.
Well, let's say also that Amtrak gave the state and the local community something of an ultimatum a couple of years ago saying,
absolutely.
This is, and we found out that this was the lowest ridership line that they have, I mean, bar none. And they said, we need subsidies from the local communities and from the state to keep this going. And you've done that over the last year. And it seems to me still somewhat unclear whether that subsidy will have to continue in the short term as Corridor Capital or some other firm takes it over.
Well, and that's the point right now. I mean, after we went through the process with the state, after we decided to go ahead and get some skin in the game, we felt that we did have a strong voice in making a decision as to what the future of this line is going to be. We, at that point in time, decided to go out and get bids to see who might want to take that service over. We are now in the process of screening those bids. And, of course, like anything else, people are offering up amazing service. They're offering up cars that are going to have Wi-Fi. They're going to have bar cars. They're going to have food service. They're going to do all kinds of stuff. But each time that you get that opportunity to improve the service, it comes with a cost. And that puts us back to square.
Have you been asked for an additional subsidy as the service changes hands at all?
Well, not necessarily. We're still in the process of making some determinations to which service we're going to select. But in the event that that happens, it is going to be a more expensive line. It's going to cost, obviously, more to run it because it's going to be a higher degree of service. And it's also going to cost us as providers, in a sense, a little bit more money as well. So what we're looking at now is who's going to provide the best service, who's going to give us the biggest bang for the buck, and if we, as local government, are going to be in a position to be able to continue to subsidize it.
Well, one of the big issues, of course, is that the line itself is based on riding on rails that are designed for freight trains, not for passenger rail, as you mentioned. That would seem to be one of the problems that's going to continue to be endemic about getting from here to Chicago. Is that something you want to continue to be a part of, or does it need to be sort of burn the village to save it and figure out a way to create a new route?
Well, it's difficult to say right now because the priority is freight. Oftentimes when there's delays in service, it's because the passenger rail has to wait for freight service to go through the line. And that can take up from minutes to hours. Other issues are staffing. You know, there are certain regulations that the rail service providers have to abide by when it comes to the number of hours that staff can serve on a particular train. And it's unyielding. You reach that time limit, you have to stop and you have to get off the train, because if you don't, then the employee is subject to fine and a substantial fine. So there's a lot of problems within that line. So it's going to be a real challenge, and it's going to be a difficult decision for us in local government to make. When we get back to square, you know, it's our taxpayers' dollars, and it's going to come through our legislative bodies to make that decision. They were gracious enough to grant us the authority to provide the subsidization for this 1 year to see if we can improve the service and get a private contractor, if needed, to go ahead and improve the line. From this point on, it's really difficult to say where we're going to go within our next step, because it's not just Tippecanoe County. It's not just Lafayette, West Lafayette, and Tippecanoe County. It's also the other cities on the line.
I was going to ask you if you've spoken to, for instance, the mayors of Rensselaer mm-hmm. or Crawfordsville to find out where they are on this, and indeed where the rest of their lawmaking bodies are in mm-hmm. terms of here's what we need to see if we want to continue to support this in some way.
Well, we actually had a conference call yesterday, and it was involving Amtrak and those of us who are participants on this particular spur. And the general consensus is right now we need to have some hard numbers. We need to know what our costs are going to be. And then from that point, we'll be better able to make an informed decision. But each and every participant on the route recognizes the fact that we cannot be the financial stream to continue this indefinitely. It has to at some point be able to sustain itself. And from my perspective, it'll be an issue that if it comes down to it, I'll present it to my legislative body and they'll go ahead and make the decision.
This is Ask the Mayor on WBAA. We're talking with West Lafayette Mayor John Dennis. Give us a call at 496-1999. Tweet your questions to @WBAAnews on Twitter. I've also heard a bunch of people talking about, speaking of transportation, the mm-hmm. 231 corridor. I've sat around a number of breakfast tables in restaurants over the last couple of months, and I hear people off in the distance talking about 231. And one thing that I haven't heard people say is what they're looking forward to seeing mm-hmm. along that new corridor. What are the plans for that? What do you hope people will see in the coming months and years that draw them to take that route?
Well, obviously, that was one of the main reasons when we started doing the annexation proposal. That was one of the main things that we were looking at. We wanted to make sure that that new corridor was something that would really be a gateway to West Lafayette and Purdue University and celebrate our uniqueness and our specific personality. Right now, I'm going to speak in generalities here, but probably if you look at the corridor from the southernmost point where it intersects with old 231, then up to the northernmost point where it intersects with 52, about half of it is owned by Purdue. It's Purdue Research Foundation, Purdue Research Park that owns that. So that's going to be a very specific type of development that's going to go there. The other half is basically zoned right now general business or GB, and that's sort of up to the private market. What we in the city want to see is we obviously don't want that to be, you know, just gas station, Taco Bell, McDonald's, Burger King. We feel that there's sort of an aesthetic that we're looking forward to.
So you don't want chain businesses specifically?
Well, you know, there's limits to what government can do. You know, we obviously can't say you yes, you no. We're not in a position to be able to do that. But what we can do is we can have a pretty strong voice in what that is going to look like. We're in position to sort of incentivize an aesthetic appeal that we feel strongly about and also make a strong recommendation of what we don't want to see. Obviously, because of the connectivity to Purdue and the connectivity to the city of West Lafayette, there's other interests that are curious about the potential of putting something out there. We've had some healthcare institutions curious about building out there, and that's always a great anchor to have in a newly developed area because that spurs other like developments. We feel that that would be very encouraging because when we did our strategic plan just a few years ago, it was made abundantly clear to us that we need to have a stronger presence of and healthcare opportunities here in our community. Other things that obviously pop up, again, because of our proximity to Purdue, is residential. However, right now, sociologically speaking, the students have decided they're inclined to want to stay closer to campus. So that would be something we'd have to have some pretty involved conversations about.
You mentioned the aesthetics of the area. When you're saying aesthetics, do you mean how the place looks? Do you mean that you want locally owned businesses? Mm-hmm. Do you mean that you want, regarding a healthcare institution or something like that, something that dramatically affects the tax base in a positive way. What do you mean when you say aesthetics?
Yes. No, actually, all the above. You know, we want to make sure that we have great service opportunities for our citizens and our students. And that's why healthcare is obviously a concern. You know, let's face it, when developers are looking at opportunities to build, there is nothing that appeals to them more than a major corridor in which to link into, because you're going to have a higher volume of traffic and higher visibility. So there are a lot of citizens who have expressed interest in having franchise restaurants there, national franchise quality restaurants there. We're sympathetic to that. But it really gets down to what is it going to look like? And that includes green space, that includes setbacks, that includes the actual physical structure that's going to be there. And that's what our plan is to try and have a very strong voice about. And also, you have to understand that this is a state highway, and we're concerned about speeds, we're concerned about traffic volume, and that's going to be taken into consideration as well.
So with respect to the traffic that goes through there, what do you tell the people who are nearby? And this gets back to the whole idea of annexation. I mean, mm-hmm. what are you hearing from the people who are proximate to the new road? Are they happy with it? Do they have concerns that they'd still like addressed?
Well, actually, the first concern that was expressed was the sound, was the noise. There was a lot of noise coming through the actual highway. And so we went ahead and did some things to mitigate that. And some of it's going to take a little bit longer to take effect because it was plantings, and that'll go ahead and take care of itself. But the second thing was that people were delighted with the fact that it was alleviating some of the traffic and some of the congestion within the city. They felt that that was something that was critical when they were trying to get from point A to point B. And with that bypass, now that sort of has alleviated some of that traffic, more specifically the heavy traffic, the truck traffic. But other than that, people are just as curious as they can be about what is it going to be like. And they've not been shy at all about offering up suggestions. Again, that's where the healthcare facility comes into play. That's where some of the restaurants come into play. But one of the unique things about West Lafayette, and one of the one things that we're trying to do, is we're trying to make sure that it's not unbridled growth. You know, we want to make sure that it fits our unique personality, and that it's not just going to be something that, you know, the proverbial build it and they will come. We want to make sure that it really is something that we can all be proud of, you know, 10, 15, 20 years from now.
What do you think is the general mood of the people who went through the annexation process, both the people who got annexed mm-hmm. and the people who you decided did not need to be part of that? I mean, are you getting differing opinions?
In a bit, yeah. We took in one subdivision, a small subdivision just off McCormick Road, and it was rather combative. When we met with that neighborhood, they were pretty insistent that they didn't want to be part of the city. They loved their independence. They loved living in the county. They were concerned about specific ordinances and things that the city has that could conceivably affect adversely their quality of life. Since annexation, we've had some contact with those folks again, and they're delighted. they're actually pretty delighted about being part of the city. We went out just after annexation, before we were actually legally required to, we went out and went door to door and asked the folks, hey, do you want us to start picking up your trash? Do you want us to start picking up your recycling? And for the most part, they were inclined to want us to do so. So we actually reached out and started providing the service to them before we were legally responsible for that. And we also started removing their snow. And so we developed some goodwill. And from that point on, it's been a pretty positive relationship. Now, the folks that did not get annexed, if you recall, it was relatively contentious with some of the neighborhoods further to the west. And at that point in time, we felt, okay, maybe we'll just give this a miss for now and maybe revisit it sometime in the distant future. And that's been sort of a 50-50. The folks that didn't want to be brought in are satisfied that they weren't. And some of the folks that wanted to be brought in are hoping that we'll revisit that issue and conceivably bring them in.
That was my next question, was what are you telling the people in those subdivisions about mm-hmm. the future prospect of annexation? Is it, we didn't do it now, but you'd better be prepared that there's a chance we do it later? Or has anyone been given an assurance that, no, we've decided this subdivision we're going to leave off for some extended period of time?
Well, it depends upon growth. It depends upon a lot of factors that we'll have to look at. But, you know, I'm a strong believer in making sure that when you grow, you get the growth under control. You know, when you look at a city, you look at the city, the boundaries, you need to make sure that what you are doing, you can do. And I'm not just trying to speak in circles. You know, oftentimes when you annex an area, and if it's a high service area, which there are lots of houses, you have to pick up lots of trash, you have to shovel lots of streets, that requires staffing, it requires equipment, it requires all kinds of things. And to do so irresponsibly, to do so with in such a magnitude that you're not in a position to efficiently do that, well, that's going to decrease the quality of life for those citizens brought into your city, and that's not going to make anybody happy. So right now we're sort of looking at what we've got. We're looking at how we're going to provide services to those folks, and we're going to sort of set back a little bit and make sure that we're going to be able to do what we need to do and do it in a way that's going to make everybody, our new citizens as well as our existing citizens, happy.
This is Ask the Mayor on WBAA. I'm Stan Jastrzebski. We're in studio with West Lafayette Mayor John Dennis. You can call us 496-1999 if you've got a question for the mayor. You can also send an email to ask@WBAA.org or tweet your questions to WBAA News on Twitter. Last week, you and Mayor Roswarski were part of a group that was advocating for what you were calling a single entry or a single point of contact agency or shelter, I'm not sure what you want to call it, for homeless services, part of a comprehensive look at how do we solve this problem. What led you to deciding that that sort of consolidation is the way to go?
Well, we have experienced, obviously a little background. I was with the city of Lafayette for 23 years, and I retired as deputy chief of police over there. And so I'm very familiar with Lafayette, and I know the makeup of the community, and I know the makeup of some of the social services over there. And even in my time in Lafayette, we found that there are just a lot of gaps in the services that were provided. And then for somebody who's not familiar with those services, how to go from point A to point B to get some of the things that the essential, needs of life satisfied. And it wasn't because of any lack of heart or enthusiasm or skill or even, effectiveness on the part of the service providers. It's just that the system was broken up in such a way that it made it very difficult to get from point A to point B to point C. So we felt that it was important for us to have an overview of the programs that we provide and then see if there's a way that we can make it more efficient. And again, for some of us, because of our familiarity with that, it's a little bit challenging to have that level of objectivity. So we had the groups get together and people would actually have conversations about what worked and what didn't work and then what we could do to try and make that better. And we felt that having the, and again, this sounds rather cliche, but the one-stop shop is going to be a way to make this more efficient for those folks that are underserved currently. And that's our main objective. We realize that between both cities and in the county, our population is booming. And the more attractive you are, the more people you attract. And some of that's for the better, pro-social folks that are going to contribute to the overall wellness of the community, and some of it's not so good. But either way, it's imperative that we're in a position to be able to provide services for those who are in need. And it needs to be done in a way that's going to be most efficient. So putting it under one roof, making it, and again, the cliche of one-stop shopping, I think is going to be beneficial for us, who are service providers, and then for those who are currently underserved.
It seems like there's a question of how far that can actually go. Can you have one place where all of the services are actually taken care of, or does it revert back to a place where you get your answers? You go, you walk in and you talk to people who are in the know, and they say, aha, you need to go over here, and you need to solve your problem in this place. So it becomes more of an information stop than it does an actual providing of services stop. How do you view it materializing?
Again, I think both. There are some folks that are in need of services like mental health services. And again, when you look at our homeless population, there is a strong need for mental health services. When they come into a shelter now, the immediate need is the issue is solving what their immediate needs are: food, shelter, in some cases, medical care. And the mental health aspect of it sometimes gets left behind. It would be fantastic, and I think that that's part of what might be intended, to be able to see if there's somebody who could provide them with the resources to be able to do so if they're in a position to be able to realize those resources. Again, in a perfect world, it would be beneficial for everybody if we were in a position to do some preliminary screening and assessments. But oftentimes, because of the spectrum of those whom are underserved, you really might not have that opportunity. So I think, yes, information is going to be available. But again, it'll be done with somebody who's going to be in a position to make an assessment to see if that information is actually being absorbed.
you mentioned the idea of a population boom. I lived and worked in Bloomington for mm-hmm. 5 years, and Bloomington makes a very pointed effort towards serving the homeless population there. Mm-hmm. And some people have said that because Bloomington has gotten that reputation, that more homeless people make their way somehow to Bloomington mm-hmm. to access those services. And that worries some people there who say, look, we are serving people who are not Bloomingtonians, who are coming in to try to get whatever it is that we are able to offer them. Is that a worry at all in Tippecanoe County that you're going to – being that you've got a major highway artery and there mm-hmm. are some people who are migratory, for lack of a better term, mm-hmm. Do you worry that all of a sudden that population boom will extend to the homeless population if you start up this one-stop shop?
Well, that's always a possible option, I guess, or at least a possible counter option. But the fact of the matter is that even when I was a police officer in Lafayette, we had a homeless population. Back in those days, the resources were very limited. And our homeless population generally lived under the bridge or in abandoned buildings or something to that effect. And there wasn't the outreach programs that we have now. Well, the programs exist, and they are very efficient. They are serving a growing population. That is sort of the word on the street. You know, again, you hear oftentimes that if we didn't have these services, then our population would decrease. And I don't really believe that to be true. And again, it's because of what I saw 20, 25, 30 years ago. You know, there were people who were in need then and people who didn't get the services then. And we had a homeless population back then. Is it greater now because of what we're in a position to offer? I don't know. Is it greater because of our economy? I don't know. It's difficult to say. Because if we use that as a model, then that means if we shut all of our services down, would our homeless population disappear? And I don't think so. I don't think that would be the case at all.
It led me to consider the housing situation in both cities as well. There was an interesting piece in the Journal and Courier not long ago about the number of dilapidated and abandoned houses mm-hmm. that are in the area. And I've noticed that there are cities, usually much larger cities, Detroit, Chicago, mm-hmm. et cetera, that are selling off properties at literally pennies on the dollar, mm-hmm. pennies on the thousands of dollars mm-hmm. in many cases. And I wondered if that was something that would be considered as part of a solution here, because you've got homes that are, for instance, owned by Habitat for Humanity that they can't work on because of some reason or another. You've got mm-hmm. homes that have fallen into such severe disrepair mm-hmm. that you would need someone to live in it and do some work on it. And you could put sweat equity back into it that would mm-hmm. hopefully make the house better over some period of time. Is this part of the solution that needs to be considered to try to find – I mean, because obviously the homelessness problem is solved by finding permanent housing for mm-hmm. people who are homeless.
Sure.
Is this something that's been talked about at all?
Well, we have two cities that have a lot of similarities and a lot of differences. You know, in the city of West Lafayette, we have the available property that we have doesn't stay available very long, because we have a very significant transient population, you know, the students, the professors, the graduate students who will take advantage of properties like that, whether they be rental or whether they be, you know, owner-occupied, but the owner could be on sabbatical or something to that effect. So we really don't have a lot of vacant properties over here. And I really can't speak to what the program is in Lafayette, but I do know that they have a very aggressive code enforcement program, and that's often what they use to try and deal with some of the abandoned properties. We also have the same thing with our neighborhood resource team, but there are limits to what government can do. The presumption is that if there's a blighted property and it's creating a hazard, that government can go in there and scrape it, and if nothing else, have some green space until something should take its place. But because of property rights and property owner rights, there's very, you know, we can't necessarily do that at the drop of a hat. There's quite a bit of protocol that we have to abide by before we're in a position to do that. But the fact of the matter is again, you know, your homeless population, the availability of abandoned properties, the availability of rental properties, you know, there probably is a link. But I wouldn't say that that's one of the single contributing factors to the increase in population.
There's also the issue of money whenever we're considering mm-hmm. what the county or both cities would have yeah. to contribute to make this agency run. What kind of estimates have you gotten about what the financial contribution might have to be on a year-to-year basis from West Lafayette?
Well, with the information that I've been exposed to, we haven't made it. We haven't gotten that far yet. The press conference was basically to say, here's a problem. We've identified the problem, and this is a solution we would like to pursue. You know, the good news and bad news about our social services is that they ebb and flow, as does everything. You know, it's difficult in tough economic times to get the revenue to sustain existing programs. And our hope is that in this community, we're very fortunate. You know, we have a lot of citizens that really believe in helping their neighbor, and they contribute to our social service organizations. So we're sort of a leg up when it comes to that. But still, financially, we're all very challenged. And so our hope is that with strong support, we might be able to take that to the next level. But right now, it's just in the very beginning stages.
Just a few more minutes to call or tweet your questions to West Lafayette Mayor John Dennis on today's Ask the Mayor program. Our telephone number 496-1999. Our Twitter address is WBAA News. You know, there have been some questions raised about what happens. We had 2 days of allowing same-sex marriage last week, and people have said, well, what happens now with respect to the services that are offered to those couples, either from municipalities or from the state? What happens, for instance, if these appeals go beyond the end of this calendar year and we're into a different tax year, which seems likely at this point? I mean, everybody from Senate President Pro Tem David Long on down has said the Supreme Court needs to decide this, and that's clearly not going to happen before a hearing in October and a subsequent decision probably as late as next June.
Sure.
What happens on a very local level? Anything? Is there any question that you have to resolve about what services or benefits are offered to those people who did get a marriage license?
Well, you know, that's a great question. And I was privileged to be able to go ahead and preside over a wedding just before the deadline came in. And it was a pretty moving experience. But the way I understand it, and I'm not a lawyer, nor do I pretend to be. But the fact of the matter is that the unions that were officiated over when permissible by the state will stand. Obviously, nothing new can happen, and they'll be empowered to the same rights of any other married couple until a decision is made. And then at that point, that will validate or invalidate that union. And it will be. It'll take quite some time. I mean, if every day you open the newspaper, you know, there's courts striking down the marriage ban in every state in the union. And I think that that's going to probably be a strong influence on what the Supremes are going to do when it gets to that level. But again, you know, we've had these conversations for years now. And it's abundantly clear to me that we as a society are shifting. You know, it's no different than what we did at the turn of the last century with racism and some of the other issues we had to deal with back then. You know, we are growing, we are evolving, and this is yet another step in our societal evolution.
So what does it do in terms of you having to provide benefits, be it insurance coverage or medical coverage, which of course eats into the bottom line for the city? I mean, are you working through those issues?
Yes. Actually, with our HR director, we've had those conversations already, and we will recognize, as we have with other marriages and other legal unions, we'll go ahead and just travel down that path.
Is this something you've come across before where someone has gone to a Massachusetts or an Iowa or a California or something and gotten a marriage license in those states and come back to West Lafayette and said, look, I have a legal marriage license. You have to honor it. You have to give me the benefits to which I'm entitled. Is this anything you've come across before?
No, not yet. You know, a lot of times what happens is, you know, when we have these conversations, there are real passionate, you know, positions on both sides. And it just seems that, you know, when you look at a relationship and you look at how it progresses over the years, and then you look at when decisions need to be made, whether it be life and death decisions, whether it be about distribution of assets, it would seem to me only logical that we would go ahead and validate that legally. But in the state of Indiana, we do not. So I think we're getting closer with that. But insofar as the city of West Lafayette, we, you know, like I said, I presided over one union, and all the rights that have been, you know, recognized in other unions will reach out to these folks.
Lastly, in just our last 90 seconds or so, next week there are going to be a couple of pianos delivered to public places in West Lafayette. And it's an interesting idea toward public art, because it becomes public performance art in some way, and it's not just something that you're interacting with on a visual level. When you presided over the Board of Works meeting a couple weeks ago that said this was okay to go ahead with, it was, the idea was that if this was successful enough that we could go ahead with it and expand it maybe in the future. Mm-hmm. What do you need to see to make that happen?
As far as I'm concerned, just public appreciation. You know, I mean, we're actually going to be involved. Tony and I both are going to be involved in the rollout of this. And I've told them that I can play Chopsticks, I can play Heart and Soul, and I can play the theme to Batman. So, you know, if that helps get the program kicked off, that'll be fantastic.
All right. This has been Ask the Mayor. I'm Stan Jastrzebski. Have a good afternoon, everybody.